Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Kathy from Perry Hall Speakers Group in Maryland.
That was really cool. Can we do that again?
No, stop.
Hi, everybody. I'm Kathy. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank you all for having me here. Congratulations on your anniversary. It is such an honor and a privilege to be here, and it's so good to see so many familiar faces. I've got some very dear friends in this room, and it's always nice to meet the friends I haven't met yet. I want to thank Annie, my friend Annie, for riding up here with me. It's a long drive, and man, we can suck all the oxygen up in the car, you know. We were really getting into the girl talk on the way up, and I've come to really appreciate the ride. You know, sometimes I think the whole purpose for the meeting is the ride. I get so much out of them. I guess I'll just start. I'll start in the beginning. I live in Bel Air, Maryland. I've lived there for over 20 years. Those of you that know me know that I didn't grow up there. I was just talking to Trace about, you know, it's a curse. You're born with it and you're stuck with it. It's like a speech impediment. I can't lose it. But I grew up in Boston, a little town, about 20 miles north of Boston. And I had a wonderful life. I've got a wonderful family. I have nothing to blame my alcoholism on. You know, I got two parents that were married for 49 years. I've got a younger brother and sister. We grew up in a beautiful home in the suburbs. Good schools, good neighbors. You know, all of my needs were met and pretty much all of my wants. There's nothing environmental that I can blame my alcoholism on. And I'm glad. I'm really glad that I don't have anything to blame that on, because then I'd have a resentment I could carry the rest of my life. And I got enough of those. I don't need any more. But I know that this is mine. I know that I was born an alcoholic. That doesn't mean that I have to die from this disease. I'm going to die an alcoholic, but I'm recovered today. And I don't have to die from my alcoholism. I know that I was born an alcoholic because I have never been like anyone else. I always felt different. Even way before I ever took a drink, I was an alcoholic. I had all the isms. I've always been selfish and self-centered, and everything has always been about me. What I was going to get from you, what am I getting out of life? You know, what are you bringing to the situation? And if you didn't have anything I wanted, I didn't waste my time on you. I had no sense of belonging, no sense of love. I didn't feel wanted or accepted. I was sure that you didn't like me. I went to great lengths to make sure that you liked me. I was a wonderful actress. I had many masks that I wore, a lot of faces that I put on so that I could fit in with any group of people. I remember being in school, and you know, they've got all those different groups. You know, you got the jocks and the geeks and the freaks and the science club people and the potheads. They're my favorite. I love the potheads. You know? I don't like pot. I do not like it at all. It makes me way too paranoid, you know. And I'm paranoid enough, thank you. But the potheads were really cool. I thought they were cool anyway. You know, we'd all cut class, and we'd be hiding behind the bleachers at the back of the school, and somebody would yell, "The principal's coming!" You know, and everybody scatters like rats, you know. Except the heads. They just stood there like, all right, you know. And I wanted to be just like them, you know. Then I found out later that they'd been in the 10th grade for 3 years, you know. But I had all kinds of friends, you know. Everybody fit into one of these little cliques, but I didn't. I fit into all of them. I had to, because I can't stand disapproval. The faces, the masks that I wore, they worked sometimes. They worked if I was only with a certain group of people. I'd be with my jock friends, you know, and I was very jockey. I was head cheerleader, and I dated the captain of the football team, and I was very nauseating. And I was okay when I was, like, with them, but put us into a social situation, like a beach party. You know, where I grew up, you can't drive 10 minutes in any direction and not hit water. And that's where we partied, you know. It was 100 years ago. The cops didn't bother us. And I would be with one group of friends and drinking and partying and having a good time. And okay until another group walked up. You know, like the heads would walk up. And I'm friends with them too. And then how do I act? You know, which face do you wear? Which mask do you put on? And I was always living in fear. I was terrified. You know, I was always looking over my shoulder because I knew that one day one of you was going to figure me out for the phony that I was. And I was always scared. You know, the big book talks about that, you know, 100 forms of fear, 1,000 forms of fear, whatever it is. I relate to that so well. I was always scared. I was scared of everything. I never, ever looked at the fact that I was letting fear control my life. Until I did a fourth step, and I was like, oh, my God, I'm afraid of everything and everyone, you know. I really think the 12-step program should be a prerequisite before you graduate high school, you know. Except that people have to want it. You can't make them do it, but it just makes a lot more sense to me. Anyway, I started drinking at 14, and like most of you, I'm sure, you know, I started drinking just to fit in, to blend. I was with older kids. They were drinking. I wanted to fit in. And made a conscious decision to get drunk. Not have a drink. Could have walked around with one drink all night and no one would have known the difference. I made a decision to get drunk. I was 14, about 90 pounds soaking wet, and I drank a six pack and I immediately went into a blackout. Love those blackouts. That was the point. I mean, why else would you drink, right? You know, I'm not one of those people that likes like fine wines and frilly, girly drinks with the little umbrellas and the fruit in them, you know. I want to get from point A to point B fast, you know. I want that blackout. And I've always been a scotch drinker. But, yeah, they say it's an acquired taste. I don't know. Maybe it's the Irish in me, but I took to it. Fine. No problem. But this night, you know, I like I said, I was real young and real tiny, and I drank a whole six-pack and blacked out and don't remember anything from that night except waking up face down in the sand the next morning where they left me. But, yeah, covered in flies and whatever. But that was the night that the magic happened. And if you're a real alcoholic, you know exactly what I mean. And if you don't, you know, if you don't know what I mean, then you never will. That was the night that I found my solution. I found my solution for living. Up until that point, I couldn't be me. I couldn't be happy just being me. I had a million voices in my head that were all mad at me. And I was always fighting with, you know, I was always fighting with somebody. You know, I'm one of those people that could never sleep because I couldn't turn my head off. I would lay in my bed and, you know, just watch the clock, watch the time spin, and think, if I just go to sleep right now, I'll get 4.5 hours sleep, you know, and then 15 minutes later, if I fall asleep right now, you know, but I couldn't turn my head off until that night that the alcohol first hit me. It was like I had been listening to a 24-hour talk radio station over and over and over, and I couldn't stop the noise. And then when the alcohol hit me, it was like some big hand just turned the dial just a little bit so that what I was getting was static and it was peaceful and it was quiet and I was comfortable to be me. And that was the effect that I saw for the next 25 years of my life. I know that a lot of people, when the alcohol first hits them, they say that, you know, it made them taller and smarter and, you know, better looking and better dancers and their acne fell off and all that stuff. And I believe that's true because I hear a lot of people say that. But that wasn't my effect. You know, that wasn't my experience. My experience was that I was still short and fat and uncoordinated. You know, the only difference was I didn't care. I didn't care anymore what you thought. And that made it comfortable to be me. I was never an everyday drinker until the very end. I was never a daily alcoholic. I've always been a binge drinker. I try to make a point of saying that at meetings, because when I first got here, I didn't know that there were different kinds of alcoholics. I thought an alcoholic was an alcoholic. And for months, I would sit here and listen to people from the podium talking about how they couldn't get through a day or even get through an hour without a drink. And I almost talked myself right out of these rooms because I thought, I never drank like that. So I guess I'm not an alcoholic. Until one night I heard a gentleman at the podium, and he was talking about binge drinking, and that was the first time I heard that word. And he said that what made him an alcoholic wasn't how much he drank or what he drank or how often he drank. What made him an alcoholic was the fact that if he put even an ounce of alcohol into his system, at that point he ceased to be in control, and the alcohol controlled him. And that was the first thing that made sense to me, and I knew that I belonged here. I can't say that I was happy about that thought. I said, oh, God, I'm one of them. You know, it was like a life sentence. I'll get into that later. I'm getting ahead of myself. But, you know, I'm one of those people that I put everything behind me. You know, I bottle everything up. I would be the designated driver when we all got our licenses and everybody would drink. And, in fact, all the moms loved me because I was the good girl. You know, I was the cheerleader. I didn't drink. I didn't party. And they knew that if their kid was out with me that she was going to get home safe. Until life got too much for me. You know, I just didn't know how to deal with feelings or emotions. You know, I didn't know how to deal with anger or rage or grief or happiness or joy. I just didn't know what to do with it. I come from an old-fashioned Irish Catholic family, you know, and they're very stoic people, and we just don't show emotion. And I didn't know what to do with that. And that's not their fault. That's the way they were raised, and that's who they are. But I couldn't handle it, and that's when I would drink. You know, everything would build up, and I'd feel like a pressure cooker, and I had to let off steam, and that's when I would drink. And I'm one of those people that goes on benders. We were just talking about this in the car. I would disappear for days. I'm one of those people, you know, in the movies that, like, goes out for cigarettes on Friday and doesn't turn up till Wednesday, you know. And I say turn up because I was never home, you know. And this was, you know, in the land before cell phones, and you actually had to get a pay phone, you know. I never knew where I was. I never knew who I was with. I didn't know where my car was. I didn't know what had happened. And I'd have to call people and find out, you know, where am I? Who am I with? Where's my car? How do I get home? And that was horrifying. And what was even more horrifying was the person on the other end of the phone was always trying to tell me what I had done in the blackout. A four-day blackout, I don't want to know, you know. That was the point of the blackout, you know. I don't want to go there. But then I would say to myself, God, that was awful. I'm not going to do that again. And I wouldn't. I could put a couple weeks together, sometimes a couple months, until life got too much. And I'd go on another bender. You know, this was when I was real young. I was like 17, 18, 19 years old. I'm a mom today. I have two teenagers, 17 and 18. If one of my kids disappeared for a couple of days, you would have to medicate me and put me in a rubber room. I can't imagine what I put my parents through, what I put my family through. And I never looked at that. I never thought about it, you know. I had to do what I had to do for me. It didn't matter who I was affecting. I never thought I was affecting anybody but me. I did all the things that the big book says that we do. You know, and I never knew that anybody else did the stupid things that I did until I read the big book, and I was like, oh, thank God, there's other people like me. But I tried the geographic thing. You know, I tried the relocation. I moved all over the country. That didn't work because, you know, it was the place that sucked, and I had to move, right? And then you get to another place, and you find people like you, and then that place sucks, and then you got to move to another place, and, you know, the problem was I brought me with me. You know, no matter where you go, there you are. So I was kind of screwed. But I tried all the stuff. You know, I got a really good job. I made more money than I deserved to be making at such a young age with no education. And I had the company credit card, and I traveled around the country. And, man, I thought I was it, you know. I thought that the prestige and the position was what I needed to fix me, because I knew that there was something really broken. and that didn't work. And so I thought I needed stuff. I saw success in people through the stuff they had. My parents had nice stuff. They were happy. That's what I need, my own stuff. So I was in Virginia at this point, and I bought a beautiful little townhouse in Alexandria, and I filled it with all the latest stuff, you know, all the nice furniture and the paintings, and I had drapes and all the latest, well, latest 8-track, you know. But I had all the stuff, you know. I had the bitchin' Camaro. I had all the stuff that went with it. I had everything that should have made me happy, and I wasn't. I was miserable. Because it's just stuff, you know. It doesn't make you happy. It doesn't comfort you when you're scared or keep you warm at night. It's just stuff. And when you're an alcoholic like me, you know, stuff gets old in about a minute. So then you need new stuff, you know. So that didn't work. And then, of course, you know, I had to try him. And you ladies knew who him is, you know. Our mothers, you guys don't get it, but our mothers tell us these fairy tales when we're growing up, and they're tucking us into bed, and they all end up with Prince Charming and Happily Ever After, you know? So I knew that Prince Charming was going to come one day, and he was going to pull up in his big white pickup truck and carry me off to his double wide, and we were going to live happily ever after, you know? And I met him one day, and that's how I ended up in Maryland. I was in Baltimore on a business trip, and I walked into a bar, and there he was, you know, because you can see, you know, your soulmate across a crowded bar. That's where you find them, right? And I saw him, and I knew I was going to marry him, and I did 6 months later, and nightmare, yeah. We really didn't know each other well. We really didn't like each other much. The only thing we had in common was our drinking. Because at this point in my life, I was very proud of the fact that I could outdrink any man I knew. But I couldn't outdrink this one. He was a sun-up to sundown drinker. You know, he drank every day, constantly. Still does. God bless him. I pray for him today. But I think the reason that I stayed with him as long as I did is because he was my excuse not to look at me. You know, he drank more than I did. I would call him an alcoholic to his face while I'm pouring myself another Johnny Walker, you know. I never looked at me. He was the reason that we had no money, that we couldn't pay our bills, that the electric was going to get turned off, you know, because I would not only drink with him. Yeah, I blamed the fact that I drank so much on him, because I not only drank with him, I drank at him. Do that? Yeah. Like my hangover hurt him at all. But I knew right away I'd made a horrible mistake, and I should, excuse me, I'm going to pull a Dave Perry here, take my clothes off. I just noticed I'm wearing all black. I look like I'm in mourning. Sorry about that. It's my delusion. I feel like it makes me look thinner. But where was I? Oh, you know, I knew that I should have left this guy right away. I knew that I should have gotten a divorce and spared us all a lot of torture. But, you know, I told you I'm a good Irish Catholic girl, and my family doesn't look real kindly on divorce. And I was living in such self-centered fear at the time, I could not bring myself to call my family and tell them that I'd made a mistake and I'm leaving him. So I decided I was going to save the marriage, and I did what any good alcoholic would do. And I had a couple of kids, brought some more hostages in the situation, you know, like that was going to fix us, you know, like getting a puppy or something. But I'd love to stand up here and tell you that I was a good mother. In fact, when I got sober, I think I probably did tell you I was a good mother. But looking back on it now through sober eyes, I was a horrible mom. I was a terrible mom. I was not the mom that I wanted to be. I'm not the mom that you see in commercials that the kids buy them refrigerators for Christmas, you know. I never tucked them in or said prayers or sang them songs or told them stories. I never spent any time with my children. My children were in my way. They were an inconvenience. I remember stuffing oatmeal cookies in their pockets and pushing them on the bus and calling that breakfast. because I rationalized that oatmeal's a breakfast food. They would come home from school and it was, you know, go outside and play, you need some fresh air. But what it really was is mom needs a couple of drinks while she's making dinner. Then it was eat dinner, go take a bath, do your homework, and go to bed. And I would send these kids to bed way before they had to go to bed because I had a date. I knew Johnny Walker was waiting for me in the other room, and I didn't drink in front of them. I thought that's what a good mom does. I never spent any time with those children. And kids get older and smarter, you know, and they learn how to tell time, and they were like, Mom, it's only 6 o'clock. I mean, it's light out, you know? And I would chase my children down the hall with a hairbrush and tell them to get into bed because they were getting on my nerves. And I used a lot more colorful language than that. I have a vivid memory of standing at the kitchen counter, and I was putting dishes away, and my little daughter standing next to me just playing quietly, not talking to anyone, just playing. And I reached over her to put a cooking utensil away, and when I reached, she ducked. There's only one reason kids duck, and I didn't want to be that mom. I never wanted to be her, but that's where my disease drove me. And sadly, I stayed in that marriage for 11 years and finally decided enough was enough, and we were all dying and I needed to get out. And, you know, I look at it now and I just can't believe the delusion that I was living under, but I left him to save my children from the alcoholic. Never looked at me, never looked at myself or the damage that I was doing or the damage I was causing or how much I was drinking. I had to save them from their father. And I found a ratty little basement apartment. Oh, it was horrible. But I chose a building that was family friendly. You know, there were lots of families and there were single mothers and they all had teenage daughters and babysitters were plentiful. And so I thought my life was going to change. I was going to quit drinking. No one was going to tell me how to spend my money anymore. We were going to be happy. I mean, I had it all pictured in my head, you know, me and my kids playing board games and laughing. And, you know, I had the whole like Hallmark picture thing going. And I was never home. My children went from mom they were afraid of to an absent mom. And I had other children raising my children. And they never saw me. God bless them. It's a wonder they've turned out sane. But when you drink like we drink, and if you're like me and convince yourself that you drive better with one eye, you know, eventually the law catches up to you, you know. And I did. I got arrested. And that was my wake-up call, and that's what brought me here to you. And it wasn't the arrest. That's the funny thing. You know, it had nothing to do with the arrest or the trouble with the law or coming out of a blackout with the pretty shiny bracelets, you know. The name in the paper, none of that bothered me. I don't think that bothers any of us. What it was that was my wake-up call was the blackout. Now, I black out every time I drink. Every time. That's the point. This blackout was different, though, because every time I've come out of a blackout, I've always been someplace safe, at home, at a friend's house, in my car, on a couch, and I've always been waking up out of the blackout. I've been waking up from sleep. This blackout was the first time that I was ever aware of. I came out of the blackout talking, and that had never happened before. I had lost 4.5 hours. I'm handcuffed to a chair in the state police barracks being interrogated by 2 troopers. And I'm talking. And even though I was really drunk, I knew that this just was not normal. You know, normal people just don't live this way. And I thank God for that because that brought me here. They let me go on my own recognizance, go figure. And I went home and there on the coffee table was a phone book. And I opened it to the yellow pages, and thank God we have an easy name. You know, I went right to A, and there we are. And I called the hotline, and this woman was wonderful. If I could ever find her one day and thank her, because I was not nice to her, because, you know, the first thing she asked me is, what's your name, honey? And I'm like, that's rather personal, you know. I thought it was anonymous, you know. And I said, I just want a meeting. And she said, well, where do you live? And I'm like, okay, now you're going too far. We finally got through the conversation. She told me where there was a meeting near my house, and I went to a meeting that night. And I'll tell you, those people were so kind. That's all I remember from the meeting. I can't tell you what was said or what happened, but those people were so kind. And I remember that, and I try to be nice to newcomers because I know me very well. And if they had been the least bit mean, or not even mean, if they had just ignored me or been indifferent, I would not have gone back. They were nice, and they were kind, and they knew I was scared, and they welcomed me. And they gave me a big book, and they wrote their phone numbers in it, and I felt safe. And when I left that meeting, and I was driving home an hour later, I had kind of a little epiphany in the car. That hour that I sat in that meeting was the first time ever in my life, sober, that my head was quiet. There was no noise. And that had never happened unless I was drunk. And I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was the message I was hearing from the speaker. I don't know if it was the God I felt in the room, or whether it was being in a room full of my own people that I didn't have to wear any masks for, and I didn't have to be phony. I could be accepted to be just me. Maybe it was all of those things. I don't know. But I knew that I was safe there. And they had said, keep coming back. And so I did. And that's the only thing I did right. Mm-hmm. I did nothing right in the beginning. You kept telling me all these things like get a home group, get a sponsor, get a job in your home group, get the big book open and start working steps with the sponsor, get phone numbers. I did nothing. I smoked cigarettes and I drank coffee. And I had serious trust issues. I wouldn't talk to any of you because I thought the only reason you'd be nice to me is because you wanted something from me, because that's how I saw you, what I could get from you. But there were these three old guys that sat way in the back at this little picnic table. We called it the relapse table. But these three old guys were like 100 years old each, and they had about 100 years of recovery together, And they were so funny. These curmudgeons, that's the best way I can describe them. But I figured that there was nothing that I had that they wanted, so I was safe with them, and I trusted them, and I sat with these old guys, and they were mean to me. they were really mean to me. They said some nasty things, They were always barking at me. There was one guy, I think he'd had a stroke. He kind of looked like Popeye. Half of his face was all screwed up. But, I'd come in, right as they're starting to read the preamble, and I'd bolt as soon as we said the Lord's Prayer. And they would yell at me because you're not staying for the meeting before the meeting, and you're not staying for the meeting after the meeting, and they're more important than the meeting in the middle. And I'm like, English, please. I didn't understand what they were talking about. I got up to go to the bathroom in one of the meetings in the middle of the speaker, and I came back and I sat down, and Papa yelled at me. He's like, don't ever do that again. I can't pee? What? What'd I do wrong? God sent you here to hear a message, and you're going to miss it while you're in the bathroom. God, he's unreasonable, But I see now today, God loved them. They knew that I was just a walking relapse waiting to happen, and they knew I was dying. And they were telling me what I needed to hear, not what I wanted to hear. And I thank them for that, because those guys got me sober. They knew I didn't have a sponsor, and they knew that I hadn't been working any of the steps. And the program is the steps. I thought that the fellowship was going to get me sober. And I don't know why I thought that, because I never got drunk sitting in a bar watching you drink. So I don't know why I thought I could get recovery from you. But one of them grabbed me one night after a meeting, and he sat me down, and he said, Dallin, we're going to talk about the steps. And I'm like, oh, Mother of God, give me strength. And he says, tell me about the first step. And I said, okay, I got that one. I've read it a million times. We admitted that we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable because we drink. And he looked at me and he said, honey, you just added a couple of words there. It ain't broken, don't fix it. He said, say it again. And I said, well, we admitted that we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable because we drink. And he said, you are missing the whole step. You're missing it. He said, if you look closely, there's a hyphen in the middle of that sentence. Whenever there's a hyphen in the middle of a sentence, it means that there's two separate thoughts. A, that you're powerless over alcohol. You got that. You know that. you can't ever drink alcohol again. You have an allergic reaction. It sets off a physical compulsion, a mental obsession. You can't ever drink again. You know that, or you wouldn't be sitting in a church basement at 8 o'clock every night. You know, you got that. What you're missing is the second part. Your life has become unmanageable. You think that your life is unmanageable because you drink, and you got it backwards. You drink because your life is unmanageable. You know, I'm looking at him like he's medicated. I'm like, what? You know, I don't get that. And he said, how much time do you have, darling? And I was all proud of myself. I just got my six-month chip. I'm like, I got my coin here, you know. And he said, that is great. 6 months between you and a drop of alcohol. If alcohol was your only problem, by now your life ought to be just peachy. And I just stared him down because I couldn't argue with him. I couldn't argue with him because I hurt worse then than I did the day I walked in. You know, I was suffering from me, you know, and for the first time it dawned on me, you know, maybe this guy knows what he's talking about. The alcohol wasn't my problem. The alcohol was my solution. It was my solution for living. You know, it was my answer. I didn't want to feel. And I thought maybe I better listen to this guy. So his other two buddies sat down, and we tried to talk about the second and the third step, but I couldn't go there because they talk about God. And, well, they don't say G-O-D, but they say higher power, but you can't kid me. I know you're talking about God. And I don't want to hear about God, you know. I grew up in a staunch Irish Catholic household. I know God. I know all the saints. I know all the holy days of obligation. I know who you pray to for what, you know. And I believe in God. I've always believed in God. I've never doubted him. You know, I've never seen him working in my life, but I've seen him in yours. But the second step says that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I'd always believed in God. And I'd always been nuts. So could you please explain that to me? And they tried. They tried really hard, and I think they did a really good job, too. They told me that my problem was not that I didn't believe. My problem was that I had no faith. And I had always thought they were the same thing, and they explained to me that, no, they're vastly different. They're as different as sobriety and recovery. You know, what you are right now is a dry drunk. You want recovery, and you believe that God is there, but, you know, faith is interactive. Faith is a verb. You got to be part of the equation. You got to let God in. And I think that I really wanted faith in my life at that point in time. I really did want to trust God. I couldn't, though. I had bigger problems at the time. I had issues that I thought were more important than my recovery. I know today that there's nothing that's more important than my recovery. If I lose my recovery, I lose everything. But at that time, I was having some serious money issues. Serious money issues. Not financial amends. We all got those. This was like making ends meet kind of problems. I got my little paycheck coming in, and I'm raising two children alone. I'm not getting any child support. You know, I've got nothing coming in. I even tried to get food stamps, and they told me that I made $28 a year too much. God! But, you know, I've got two lawyers I'm paying for now. I got a divorce attorney and a defense attorney because they specialize. They don't multitask. I had to pay to repair the car that I totaled because I had let my insurance policy lapse because I thought I had better things to do with my money. I had to pay to replace the telephone pole that I took out. You know, they don't tell you that you have to replace those, but you do. I've got all this stuff going out and nothing coming in, and I can't afford to feed my children. My kids are living on dollar store mac and cheese. I got my cigarettes and my booze every night, but my kids are eating dollar store mac and cheese. And I had always not liked myself, but I'm starting to really hate myself. I mean, I'm beginning to really loathe myself, and now I am drinking every day because I can't stand the noise in my own head, you know? And that stuff was all, that was just everyday life. What was really tearing me up inside was the fact that Christmas was in just 3 weeks. And my kids are 6 and 7, and they believe, and I don't know how to tell them that Santa's not coming this year. I can't afford a tree, let alone put anything under it. And for the first time in my life, I was seeing how my alcoholism was hurting somebody else, how I was destroying my kids' lives again, and really hating myself. And so I went to one of my meetings, and I sat with one of my little old dudes in the back, and I'm crying, and I told him what was going on. And he says, "Honey, have you prayed about it?" Prayer. That's what I need, prayer. Yeah, I need prayer. I need cash. Can you, like, can you hook me up with, like, a rich sponsor, you know? And he looked at me, and he said, "Mortal man cannot perform miracles. Only God can do that. I suggest you hit your knees." And I said, "You know where I am in my steps. I don't know if I believe he's even listening." And he laughed at me, and he said, "God doesn't care what you believe." He said, "God believes in you. Go home and hit your knees and talk to God." And I did, because there was nothing else I could do. And I didn't know how to pray, and I didn't know how to talk to God, only those memorized prayers from my childhood. So the only thing I could come up with was, "God, please spare my kids. Just spare my kids. They don't deserve this." And I said that prayer like 100,000 times a day. And about a week and a half, like 10 days went by, and nothing had happened. And I'm ready to open a vein at this point. And I went to work one day, and I opened the place, and now I'm a nurse. And I work in this medical center. I never did get that. I'm a nurse, drugs inside. They know I'm an alcoholic, but they give me keys. I don't get that. But anyway, I go to work, and I'm opening the place, and there's three cars in the parking lot, and they're not employee cars. And I didn't quite know what was going on, but I got out of my car, and three women got out of those cars. And I didn't know them. Two of them I'd never seen before in my life, but the third one I vaguely recognized from the rooms. And they came over, and they said, "Can you come over and look in our cars, please? We'd like you to see something." And when I tell you, I was floored. They had gone shopping for my kids, and they bought my kids Christmas. And they not only bought, like, stuffed animals and games and puzzles and books and those kind of toys. They bought stockings, and they stuffed them with candy. And they bought them ski parkas and boots and snow pants and mittens and gloves. And they put a little bit of cash in an envelope so I could buy a tree. And I didn't know what to say. I mean, what do you say when someone does something like that for you? So I just kind of threw myself at the woman in the program. And I'm like, "I'm so sorry. I'm crying all over you. But you don't know what this means to me." And she said, "Yeah, I do, honey. I was once in your shoes, and this was done for me." So she wouldn't let me thank her, and I tried to tell her that I was going to pay her back. You know, it might take me forever, but I'm going to pay you back. And she said, "No, that's not how it works, sweetheart. In AA, we don't pay it back. We pay it forward. And you keep doing your steps, and you keep working your program, and one day God's going to put someone in your path the way he gave you to me. And then it'll be your turn to pay it forward." And I spent the rest of that day on a cloud because, oh, God bless you. I'm such a train wreck. Oh, I'm so sorry. Menopause really sucks. They're laughing. You'll be here too. Wait. You'll warn me if I start looking like Alice Cooper. Yeah. Okay. But you know, two really important things had happened that day, and one is that my faith in humanity was restored, because I forgot that people are good and kind, and just really want to help each other. Because I was so bitter and jaded and broken inside. But the more important thing that happened was that my faith in God was restored. Because I know who those three women were. They were the answer to a drunk's prayer. I never asked for anything for me. I asked God to spare my kids, and he did. And there was nothing under the tree that year with my name on it. And I still feel like the richest woman in the world, you know, just looking at those kids' faces. It was the most beautiful thing. And after that Christmas, I dove into my program. You know, I dove in feet first. And I ran with this thing. And I got a sponsor, a real sponsor. And it was funny, I didn't know a thing about her. I'd never heard her speak, but, you know, I saw her at every meeting I went to. She knew everyone in the room at every meeting she went to. And she was always happy. And I didn't know happy. And I wanted whatever she had. And I asked her to sponsor me. And I started actually doing the steps. I joined a home group, and I got a job in that home group. I got the speakers for that group, and I'm so selfish. I love that job so much because it forced me to go to so many meetings and find speakers for my home group. I wouldn't give it up. I had that job for a year and a half until they finally, like, took it from me. You got to share, but in going through the steps, you know, it was beautiful because I found out that I wasn't the horrible person that I thought I was. You know, I found out that I wasn't a bad person trying to get good. I was just a sick person trying to get well. And my sponsor taught me, you know, how to be proud and be proud of who I am, be a proud woman in recovery. And she said, you know, there are other women walking around here younger than you, and you might be the only big book they ever meet. If you are going to have the audacity to call yourself one of God's kids, you better act like one. And I followed her, and she didn't give me any homework, and she didn't tell me what to do. She said, get in the car, come with me. And wherever we went, I had to do what she did and shake everyone's hands. And, you know, we were at a meeting one night, and there was like a couple hundred people in the room, and again, she knew all of them, and it was really starting to piss me off. And I said, so, you, like, you got friends. How do I do that? I want that. And she said, I see you going into every meeting with that little white booklet, and you're always getting women's numbers. Have you ever called any of them? And I said, no. And she said, okay, I'm going to give you your first homework. She said, for the next 10 days, I want you to call 5 women every day. Pick 5 names and call them for the next 10 days straight. And I said, and say what? And she said, anything you want except talk about you. Should ask how they're doing. Ask how their day is going. And let me know in 11 days what happened. So I did. And for the first couple of days, they were like, why are you calling? Did you relapse? You know? And I'm like, no, I just called to say hi. Okay, bye. You know? And then it got easier. And I'd like start to chat with these women. And we'd have conversations. And then the 10th day came. And I was like, oh, thank God, that's over with. You know? And day 11, nothing happened. Day 12, my phone started ringing. Those 5 women, wondering why I hadn't called them the day before and was I okay. And I found out I had friends. But more importantly, that taught me that if I wanted to have friends, I had to be one first. And that's how she taught me. She taught me lessons by following her. She moved away. And I know that a lot of people do the long-distance thing. And then I even sponsor women out of state. And it seems to work fine for a lot of other people. But I'm sick. I'm really sick and twisted. And I need FaceTime. You know, I need a sponsor that's in front of me. And so when she moved, I knew I needed to find a new sponsor. And I wandered around sponsoring myself for a couple of, don't ever do that. the crazies come back real fast. But there was a guy that I knew in the program who was like 50, and he had, I don't know, 100 years of recovery, and I always saw him happy, and I always saw like a mountain of guys following him, and they all seemed to be happy, and I knew that he had what I wanted, so I went to him to ask him to like recommend a woman who did what he did, because I couldn't find any women that were doing what my sponsor had been doing. And as I'm waiting to talk to him one night, this little girl comes up and she says, oh, I'm sorry. I don't mean to line cut. I just want to say hi to my sponsor. And she jumped up and kissed him on the cheek and ran away. And I thought, oh, my God, he sponsors women. And it was like I felt the hand of God smacking me on the back of the head. Like, why do you need him to recommend someone when he's got what you want? And at that point, I had 5 years of sobriety. And I needed spiritual growth. I needed to be close to God. And that's exactly what he did. And the first night that we met to go to a meeting together, I said, so I need direction. I need homework. What do you want me to do? And he just smiled at me and he said, get in the car. Come with me. Do what I do. And I knew that God put the right sponsor in my path. He was exactly like my first sponsor. And my whole world started opening up. You know, I asked him if he wanted to go through the big book with me. Do you want to do the steps again? You know, I'm trying to be the good little AA sponsee. And sucking up is what I was doing. But he said, you know, I don't believe in studying the big book. He said, the big book is a text. It even says so in it. It's a textbook. He said, we don't have to memorize it. We just have to do what's in it. And he just smiled at me one day and he said, you know, if you were taking a college course and you were trying to learn Spanish, you could study that book, you could memorize every word on every page, and you could ace every test. But unless you go out and you start hanging out with Spanish-speaking people, you're not going to learn to speak Spanish. He said, I don't want you sitting in your room studying this thing. Take it with you and go try to teach it to someone else. And that's when my world started opening up. You know, the big book came alive for me when I tried to teach it to someone else. And I tried to share it with other people. And I very often got it wrong, and I screw up a lot. I am not perfect at this thing. But luckily, he's a phone call away. So I can just go, okay, what is this page, you know? Isn't it funny how the sex stuff is on 69? I love that. We're on this page again, you know? But, sorry, I digress. But, you know, my life has just opened up, and it's become so awesome. I can't tell you how beautiful my life has become. I told you that I had a miracle, and I've seen a lot of miracles. I witnessed a lot of miracles happening in people around me, and that's a beautiful thing. But those are all spiritual experiences. That's not what keeps me sober. The spiritual awakening came as a result of working the steps. And the spiritual awakening and the growth and the sobriety and recovery come from living in the 12th step. And that's what I do today. I just live in the 12th step. I try to help as many of God's kids as I can. And that gives me a high. They don't sell on the street this kind of high. You know, they don't market it. They don't put it in a pill or a bottle or crush it or snort it. Believe me, I looked. I tried. It's not out there. You know? I never knew this kind of high until I started trying to help others. I got to tell you one little story, and then I'm going to sit down and shut up. This is probably the greatest gift that I've been given in this program. I was about 3 1/2, almost 4. I don't know. It was a while ago. I was a little over 3 years sober, and I went into a meeting on a Friday night, and I was late, as usual, and they had started reading the steps and stuff, and I came in, and I sat down next to one of my buddies, and I'm looking around the room and taking inventory, you know, the way we do, seeing who's here and who's not, and who's in the back holding hands, they must be hooking up, you know, and I'm like, you know, and waving to people, and I look over, and a couple of seats over from me, there's this girl young woman, that I just love. I adore this girl. She's beautiful, young, blonde, always happy, always happy. This kid's got like 4 months sober, I think, and she's just one of those people that really got this thing. And every time I see her, she's got a car full of women, and she's going to this conference and going to that meeting, and she's just on fire. And I love this kid, except this night when I looked over at her, I almost didn't recognize her because she was a train wreck. And I didn't know what was wrong, you know. And so I lean over to my buddy, and I'm like, what is going on over here? You know, should I talk to her? Can I help? And he said, I don't think you can help. But, you know, you need to talk to her. Somebody needs to talk to her. And I said, okay, what am I walking into? You know, is it a guy thing? Did she relapse? What's going on? And he said, no, it's nothing like that. She's a good kid. She's just got some big problems. She's going through a messy divorce. She's got 2 little kids. She's got money problems. She can't feed her kids. The home group has a collection going. He said, I'm collecting money so that we can go grocery shopping, get some food in the house for those kids. And he goes, you want in on it? And I'm like, been there, you know. So I, you know, grab my purse, my suitcase of a purse, and I'm emptying stuff out on the table because I got to tell you, I'm a wicked debit card person. I never carry cash. So I'm looking for change at the bottom of the purse, and I'm, you know, hairspray, kid's inhaler, you know, I'm emptying all this stuff out. And while I'm digging through my purse, he's still yakking away. And that was when I heard it. He said, that's not what's tearing her up. The reason she's crying is because Christmas is in just a couple weeks. and my heart was in my throat, and I couldn't breathe, and I didn't hear anything for the rest of that meeting. Because it was my turn. I got a friend up in Boston that says all the time that God does not need our permission to use us. And I know that my friend had no idea that God was using him that day. But I recognized God's voice. You know, I heard it. And after that meeting was over, I blew out of there so fast. And I never did talk to her. He must have thought I was a real jackass. But, you know, Target was open and I had to get there. And I thank you. I went and I bought for her kids everything that had been bought for mine. You know, I got them stuffed animals and toys and games and puzzles and videos and snow packers and ski pants and boots and candy and put some cash in an envelope and made 100 phone calls because it's anonymous and nobody knew where she lived or anything, you know. But I finally found out where she lived, and the next morning, Saturday morning, I went over there and I called her out to look at my car, and she didn't really get it. You know, it took her a while, just staring at the car and then looking at me. And after a few minutes, it finally hit her, and it just ran her over like a truck. And she did exactly what I did, and she just broke down crying. And she fell in my arms, and she was trying to thank me, and I said, "You can't thank me, honey, because I was once in your shoes, and this was done for me." Mm-hmm. And she wanted to pay me back. She wanted to do my laundry and clean my house, and you know. And I'm like, it doesn't work that way, you know. And I said, "No, honey, you know, stick around for a while. In AA, we don't pay it back; we pay it forward." And I got to tell her what those three women had told me, you know, that she kept doing what she was doing and working a program that one day the 9-step promises would come true for her, and God would put someone in her path. Like he gave her to me. And we smuggled all the stuff in the house and hugged each other and wished each other Merry Christmas. And then I got in the car and started on my way. And as I was driving home, this is the gift. This is the gift I was given. You know, I was thinking about her and what was going through her head. Because I knew I'd been her. You know, and I knew that she thought that she got the gift that day. But what I know now is what those three women had known from 3 years before that, that I got the gift. The gift is in the giving. It's not in the receiving. It's been given to others. That's why we're here. You've been trying to tell me that my whole life, and I never heard you. Because I was too self-centered and too afraid to just reach my hand out and say hello. You know, and it's not the big stuff. It's not buying someone Christmas. It's just being a friend. You know, hey, I'm going to a meeting tomorrow night. Do you need a ride? Or I'm going back for some more coffee. Can I get you a cup? Or, you know, I know you probably got a sponsor, but can I have your number anyway? I can always use another friend. I don't know about you, but that's what I wanted when I got here. I just wanted to know that someone cared, you know? And that's my job today. And that's what keeps me sober. It's not traveling all over and going to conventions and, you know, speaking from podium. That just blows up my ego, you know? The magic happens for me when I just sit down one-on-one and talk to another alcoholic and try to help end their misery a little bit. It's 9:00, so I'm done. But if there's anybody in this room that is in pain or hurts, whether you're new or not so new, please let somebody know. There's somebody in this room that can help you. I know, because they helped me. And this isn't about staying sober. It's about living. Bill Wilson never called this a cure for alcoholism. He called it a guide for living. And I'm living. And I love my life today. God help anyone who tries to take it from me. Thank you so much for letting me.